I was putting Tyrion to bed last week, and Tyrion's 10, so he's starting to ask some cosmic questions, right? All the big stuff about God and life after this life, and it's fascinating. It's a very, very fun stage. And so I had him already tucked in, and we were just kind of being quiet for a little bit, and he said, "Will I go to heaven if I die?" As a parent, you know, you hear a question like that from your kid, and there's something inside you that just kind of lurches. And it has a couple of parts to it, at least for me. One part, of course, is delight. You know, you want your kids to be thinking about the stuff that matters, and this is that. And there's another part, of course, that for me anyway, can't help that split second of thinking about him not being here, which is just, you know, just stalls. And then there's another part that as a parent where you go, you are such a smart little whipper. Like, you've totally got this figured out. If you can get Dad riffing on God, you don't have to go to sleep. Right? And so, like, all this stuff kind of zooms through your head. It was a serious question, and I could tell he meant it. So, "Dad, if I die, will I go to heaven?" I said, "Yeah, you will." And he was quiet for a little bit, and then he said, "Why?" Got any easy questions there, son? I said, "Because God is good." And I know there's lots of ways to answer that question. I know it could have gotten all complicated on him, but that was my answer. And I had my own matrix of reasons for that answer, I suppose, not the least of which was that it was bedtime. The other is that it's because I just profoundly believe that that's the heart of the matter. "Will I go to heaven if I die?" "Yeah." "Why?" "Because God is good." Tyrion was quiet for a little while. Maybe he was reviewing his day, I'm not sure. And then he said, "He's that good?" So I just wanted to ask him, "What'd you do? What are you worried about, man?" But what I said is, "Yeah, T, he's that good." You know, we're in this series called The Big Story. It's kind of going through the whole story of the Bible. And we started out last week, and we were in this space in these first 10 words in Genesis where the story starts with this lovely space, a space of quiet confidence that God is and God always has been. And it's kind of begins with this lovely, settled invitation in contrast to most other primitive or ancient sacred stories of the beginning, which begin with conflict, which begin with some god beating up other gods for supremacy and then moving on from there. And the Christian story, the biblical story rather, begins in a very different space than that. Begins with this God that pre-exists all that is, including humanity, and a God that's unfolding this creative project of putting together what's fragmented bit by bit, not all at once. Unfolding this reconciliation and restoration. And Genesis says that God does all of this in a way that our English Bible talks about as hovering. Near enough to evoke, but distant enough to let things unfold. Far enough away that they're not smothered by their maker, but freed by their maker. And these are all pieces of what Tyrion was asking about. These are all ways to think about the goodness of God in the story of humanity, in the story of the world that we live in the story of the beginning of this whole tale. We talked about how those opening moments in the story are like an establishing shot of a movie or the opening moments of a film or the first paragraphs of a novel. They don't just set the scene, but they also set the tone. And that the tone of the story of the Bible is one from the onset of warm invitation. And it's a very, very beautiful space. And we also spend a bit of time with the idea that the story of the Bible is like a time-lapse film of a flower opening, of something beautiful that's happening, but it's happening at a speed that we don't usually observe. And so we know it happens, but we're not really paying attention to the unfolding. But what a time-lapse film does, of course, is it compresses something that's happening over a long time into a short time, and we get to see it in a different way. And in many ways, that's what the story of the Bible does as well. It takes something that's happening over a long arc of time and compresses it into a form that we can observe and we can be impacted by. We can actually see the unfolding of this incredible creative work of God taking place in front of us. And when we do, we can be impacted by its beauty, by its loveliness. And for those of you that missed it or ignored it, we had some homework. And the homework was this idea that before we get out of bed in the morning, we would say out loud, "I am a part of the process of God's unfolding creative work." I was thinking about this moment, you know, if anybody actually tried this, and they actually tried it in the setting I suggested. And I thought maybe I should suggest an alternate setting, which would be your commute. Because my observation as a car commuter, and I know some of you commute by bike and public transit and on foot and so on, which is fantastic. As a car commuter, I often find myself parked at a traffic light next to somebody that thinks that they are actually not only inaudible to the person in the car next to them, but invisible. And they're singing at the top of their lungs on a great stage somewhere inside their car. They're just rocking out to whatever. So nobody's going to think you're nuttier than that if while you're commuting, you say out loud, "I'm part of the process of God's unfolding creative work," right? So I just wanted to give a bigger pool of possibilities for that. It's actually worth doing. And it might be helpful to think of something like that, not just as an odd idea, but as a statement of faith, a statement of belief that there might be something going on here that's hard to see in the push and shove of daily life, but once we deliberately put it in front of ourselves, once we deliberately place it there, it changes the way we look at everything that's beyond it. It actually changes our perspective on the events of the world entirely. I think there's this enormous contrast between a statement like, "I am trudging through a world that is irredeemably broken until I get to one where everything's good," and "I'm a part of the process of God's unfolding creative work." Those two ideas are almost immeasurably distant from one another. And yet I think all of us have encountered people of faith for whom their governing paradigm would match the first statement a lot better than the second one. I'm enduring life in a world that is just irretrievably trashed. I'm hanging in there until I get to one where everything is perfect. How does that affect our view of everything around us compared to getting up in the morning, understanding ourselves to be not just passengers in a train that God's driving towards eternity, but actually full-blown participants in a project that God initiated at the beginning of what we call time? Radically different perspectives on the same events. Because life can bring us all kinds of things, right? Lovely and unlovely. Well, just in case we get stuck entirely in review, we got as far as verse 3 of chapter 1 of Genesis last time. And so let's pick it up there. We won't always go quite at this pace in this series, so don't despair. I grew up in a church where, no, it's not quite true. When I moved to Winnipeg, I became part of a church community where the pastor had been preaching on Romans for 14 years, verse by verse. This will not happen here. But it might feel like it just now, so. Verse 3 of Genesis says, "And God said, let there be light, and there was light." That verse launches an entire section of Genesis where even if you look at the physical form of the text in most printed Bibles, it's set up like a sort of a sequential unfolding where God makes this piece and then the next piece and then the next piece and so on throughout all the kind of the big themes of the created world that we see around us. It's interesting that I was preparing this week and I was thinking about the name of the series, and I was thinking I should change it from the big story to the big detour, because it seems like, at least in the early going, every verse we read just takes us into this terrain that we should really stop and explore. And all these little side paths are just as intriguing as the main path, it seems to me. Some of them are even more intriguing. But I want to read a little bit more of this text. So just listen to part of this section. I won't read the whole section. "And God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, And the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it, and it was so. God called the expanse sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear, and it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds, and it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the third day, and so on. That's sort of the rhythm of this part of the poem. Verse 3, that, and God said, let there be light, kind of opens this section of the Bible that has fueled an incredible amount of debate. I think in a lot of ways it feels to me like in our generation we're inheriting this debate. It's kind of like getting born at the end of the Cold War. Inheriting a conflict in which neither side has really done much of benefit or accomplished very much. One of the gifts that the internet gives us, I suppose, I would say gift advisedly, but one of the gifts that the internet gives us is easy access to the vitriolic nature of this debate. And I find it kind of interesting, maybe a little bit sick as well, but I find it kind of interesting to go and read some of that stuff, and especially the stuff written by Christians. And then what I find interesting is to try to imagine some of the things that I'm reading coming out of the mouth of Jesus. This is a debate that has polarized a lot of people. And one way to think about what's problematic about a debate, about any debate, is to examine the extremities, to examine the poles, the outside or immoderate positions. They often help to clarify the most intensive nature of the debate. And I find it intriguing that if we think of the poles in this debate as science on the one hand and faith on the other, which is kind of a problem in itself, as I think we'll see, both sides often take a position that is not helpful. I'm not gonna take on that polarity of the terms that I just used right yet, and we'll get to that. But so we're going to stay with the language of either or for the moment and start with what's been problematic about the position taken by science in this debate. Science is its most problematic in this conversation when it is reductionistic, which is just, you know, a 12-volt kind of word for making big things small. The model on which most science that we encounter as non-scientists is practiced is one that tries to reduce things, and ultimately what science, broadly speaking, is doing in that method is trying to reduce things to mathematics, to equations. And that can lead to a syndrome in science that I heard somebody call the nothing buttery syndrome, which kind of goes like this. You see something beautiful, you see a sunset, let's say, and you say, that's a beautiful sunset. And the scientist says, oh, that's nothing but light waves being refracted through moisture and different amounts of atmosphere. It's nothing but that. You see something else, see a butterfly, something in the created world, and you say, that's a beautiful butterfly. And the scientist says, it's nothing but an insect. It's family such and so, genus such and so. And anything that we point to under this idea, science's response is, oh, that's nothing but. And when science behaves like that, that reductionistic tendency acts as though once something has been explained, once something has had some Latin or some Greek qualifiers attached to it, then there is nothing more to be said. If we can dissect it, if we can break it down into its constituent parts, then we've figured it out, and then And this is the problematic part of reductionism. And then we're all done. If we chase this critique of science down, this is as opposed to all science, okay? This is, stay in the particularity of this, it's important. But if we chase this critique down, I think it leads us to a legitimate question, which you could maybe say, we could maybe phrase it as, where does this way of thinking potentially take us? And I think we have a unique occasion in our age to live at a point in the history of Western evolution in science where this question is actually on the table in a way that it hasn't been in the last few hundred years. And partly that's true because we've grown up past the zenith of modernity where the hubris was incredible, where the optimism founded on science was, most of us would now say or experience, we would say it's untenable, but at its zenith, it behaved something like this. You know what? If the world is actually running out of the things we need, we're just going to go to another world. Science will take us there. We'll find another planet that has lots of raw material but doesn't have the right balance of atmosphere and moisture and nutrition and so on and so forth. We'll just bring those things along and put them in a bubble and we'll be fine. We're just gonna go to the moon, so to speak. I don't think we would find it easy to find very many people on this planet, this day, that would affirm that as a realistically hopeful point of view on the future. But it wasn't very long ago that was actually a tenable idea in the culture. So we live at a kind of a unique point in history. And a question like, where does this way of thinking, a reductionist way of thinking that says we're going to break things down into their constituent parts, we're going to understand them, and then subsequently we're going to manipulate them for our good, where does that led us? And there's a few different ways to phrase that. Has this line of thinking, has this way of acting in the world led us toward more toward life or more toward death? Has it led us toward augmenting the value of life or undermining, reducing the value of life? Does it lead, has it led us more toward, if we're going to use broader, more poetic terms, has it led us more toward light, more toward darkness? Does it seem to be opening up into wider vistas of meaning and joy, really essential things to humans living well? Or does it sort of feel like it's leading us down a narrower and narrower path, at the end of which we're having more and more trouble seeing light? I don't think any of those questions have foregone conclusions. I'm not posing them rhetorically in that sense. I think, though, that they're worth considering. I think that they're worth wrestling with. All right, the other side of the debate. On the other side of the debate of religion and science, we find religion entering in ways that are also not helpful. And of particular note, I think, and this is the reason I'm talking about this today in the context of our exploration of Genesis, of particular note, I think, on the not helpful side of religion are those who would regard the texts that we're looking at, that chunk that I read from Genesis chapter 1 and verses following that, the people who would regard that chunk of our sacred text as giving us a scientific explanation of the creation of the world, I would contend have not made a helpful contribution to this conversation in general. And the reason I would say that, because I know it's a fairly strong, potentially polarizing statement, the reason that I would say that is because unless we regard our Bibles as not translated by their translators, but written on a blank page by their translators, we have a very basic problem. And that very basic problem is that the writers of the Bible didn't have science in mind. Science as we know it didn't exist when this text was written. Science as we know it wasn't imagined as a possibility when this text was written, any more than going to the moon as a solution was imagined. It just wasn't there. It wasn't there in the imagination of the writer. It wasn't there in the imagination of the culture. It didn't exist in any way, shape, or form. So, why would we come to this text looking for that? That's absurd. All right. Now, what is going on in the text, because we do come to our sacred text as Christians, as people of the Word. We come to our sacred text and say, God, speak to us from this inspired text. Lead us. We want to live in the way that honors you. We want to look at the world in a way that's true to you, in a way that's true to this story. If the writers of Genesis, and it's an interesting thing to think about who the writers of Genesis were. We can't know this, of course. But it's very intriguing because not the least of the things that makes it interesting is the very great likelihood that when we read Genesis, what we're reading is a record of something that had been being moved from person to person for a long time in a non-written form that was eventually pulled together by somebody or somebodies in a written form, in the process of which the writer made some writer's decisions, or the writers made those decisions. So what were the writers of this sacred text after, if they were not trying to give us a scientific explanation for the creation of the world? They were trying to take account of the existence of the world. That's inescapable in the text, isn't it? That's what it's about. But they were not trying to account for the existence of the world by using theories and laws and systems and experiments. They were not trying to take account for the existence of the world by using science. When the writers of Genesis were trying to take account of the world, they used poetry and songs and stories. Their stories were their theories, to bring the reality of this into our context. Their stories were their way of trying to put the world into something coherent. We have, as human beings, an enormous, fundamental drive to do this. It is extremely powerful. And when we abandon the enterprise of trying to put the world into something coherent, or we abandon hope about making progress in that enterprise, we also tend to abandon things like meaning. And when we abandon things like meaning, we tend to abandon things like hope. It feels like that. And if you wonder about that, and I'm not saying that to create any kind of shame or challenge for people who are dealing with their children here. I haven't said this for all, I'm going to say it again. Pay attention to the world you're in, because it's full. It's full of the signposts of meaning. Including that. When we abandon hope, we end up in a very, very grim place. One of the things we had occasion to do this summer, when we were in London, was go to some of the galleries that contain the great works of history. We also had a chance, not all of us chose to do this, but some of us did, to go through the Tate Modern gallery, which is a stunning gallery as well. You can tour the Tate Modern online quite effectively as well, so if you're interested. The Tate Modern, though, is not a gallery that you go to and walk away going, that was lovely. At least not uniformly. Because one of the things that you discover in the art of our time, because the Tate is full of contemporary work, is that when we abandon the possibility of the world being a meaningful place, we lose hope at a level that is palpable. And when we make art out of that space, we make art that churns. Is there a place for that? Absolutely, there's a place for that. But if you try to live there, it will kill you. And if it doesn't kill you, you will kill you. And this is where we live. The abandonment of this project, the abandonment of the project of trying to frame our experience in life in a way that helps us understand it as a story that has meaning and hope, is essential to being alive as humans. It might be easy to dismiss the perspective of Genesis having said that it's not science. It might be easy to dismiss that perspective as primitive, as uninformed, as backward. There's all sorts of things about the poem, if we try to read it as moderns and we try to make it behave that way, that will be all of those things. But if we regard this piece of our sacred text as a story, as a poem, as a collection of of the narratives of the people trying to account for the world and inspired by God to do exactly that, not just for them, but for us. If we start to come at this part of the story that way, all of a sudden, it just blossoms into something completely different. And instead of being a primitive, uninformed, backward piece of pseudoscience, roughly drawn by a mind that wasn't nearly as formed as ours, instead of that, what we walk right into is a gorgeous piece of poetry that tells us something profoundly, irrevocably, hopefully true about the nature, and I don't mean hopefully true in the sense that it's hopefully true, but full of hope and truth, about the nature of our Creator and of the world that we live in. And we need that. And this piece of our Bible has it. And I think it's possible to regard a text like the beginning of Genesis rather than as primitive, uninformed, and backward, as deeply wise and insightful, and in fact, in many ways, more intelligent than many of our contemporary perspectives. This is a story, people, and this is a part of the story that talks to us about meaning. This is a part of the story that if we will let our imaginations be alive to it, this is a part of the story that says of the story we live in day by day, moment by moment, the story in which there is laughter, in which there is weeping, the story in which there is great joy and great sorrow and everything in between, the story in which there are things that we can see and understand and things that utterly baffle us. This is the kind of text that says to us all of that, all of the stuff of life is full to the brim with meaning. There's meaning in what's going on here. There's meaning in how it came to be here. There's meaning in the way that it works. There's meaning in the ways that it apparently doesn't work, or in which its workings baffle us. Is that a primitive mind at work? That's a mind captivated by the possibilities of the divine at work. That's for sure. That's a mind gripped by God at work. And Genesis offers us that. It points to the meaning of what's going on in our lives and in the world around us. It's also a text that points to the mystery of what's going on here. And I want to give us something further to consider on meaning and then something further for us to consider on mystery. And the two sources themselves are profoundly different, and that's very deliberate. I want to read you a portion of the introduction to a book that has had an enormous impact on my thinking about this conversation. The book is called The Language of God by Francis S. Collins. Collins was the guy who led the human genome mapping project to its successful completion. A very, very smart man and a deeply informed scientist. He's also a passionate Christian. And not somebody who grew up in a Christian home, grew up in a home where God was kind of like this, maybe, maybe not, you figure it out. A home full of artists, art makers. His family ran this theater company in the States. A fascinating story. Somebody who by the end of his early education as a scientist would have said that however we define our atheist agnostic thing, those terms kind of bump all into one another, but he would have said that's the space he was in. And found his way to faith primarily, actually, intriguingly enough, through the writings of C.S. Lewis. He's a rabid fan of C.S. Lewis. Very, very interesting, very warm, easy to read book, and really engaging. And Collins is himself a very engaging person. I want to just read you part of the introduction to his book. On a warm summer day, just 6 months into the new millennium, humankind crossed a bridge into a momentous new era. An announcement beamed around the world, highlighted in virtually all major newspapers, trumpeting that the first draft of the human genome, our own instruction book, had been assembled. The human genome consists of all the DNA of our species, the hereditary code of life. This newly revealed text is 3 billion letters long and written in a strange and cryptographic four-letter code. Such is the amazing complexity of the information carried within each cell of the human body, that a live reading of that code at a rate of 3 letters per second would take 31 years, even if the reading continued day and night. Printing those letters in a regular font size on normal bond paper and binding them all together would result in a tower the height of the Washington Monument in each cell. For the first time on that morning, this amazing script, carrying within it all the instructions for building a human being, was available to the world. As the leader of the International Human Genome Project, which had labored mightily over more than a decade to reveal this DNA sequence, I stood beside President Bill Clinton in the East Room of the White House, along with Craig Venter, the leader of a competing private sector enterprise. Prime Minister Tony Blair was connected to the event by satellite, and celebrations were occurring simultaneously in many parts of the world. Clinton's speech began by comparing this human sequence map to the map that Meriwether Lewis had unfolded in front of President Thomas Jefferson in that very room nearly 200 years earlier. Clinton said, "Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind." But the part of his speech that most attracted public attention jumped from the scientific perspective to the spiritual. "Today," he said, "we are learning the language in which God created life. We are gaining ever more awe for the complexity, the beauty, and the wonder of God's most divine and sacred gift." "Was I," says Collins, "a rigorously trained scientist, taken aback at such a blatantly religious reference by the leader of the free world at a moment such as this? Was I tempted to scowl or look at the floor in embarrassment? No, not at all. In fact, I had worked closely with the president's speechwriter in the frantic days just prior to this announcement and had strongly endorsed the inclusion of this paragraph. When it came time for me to add a few words of my own, I echoed this sentiment. I said, 'It's a happy day for the world. It is humbling for me and awe-inspiring to realize that we have caught the first glimpse of our own instruction book previously known only to God. What was going on here? Why would a president and a scientist charged with announcing a milestone in biology and medicine feel compelled to invoke a connection with God? Aren't the scientific and spiritual worldviews antithetical? Or shouldn't they at least avoid appearing in the East Room together? What were the reasons for invoking God in these two speeches? Was this poetry? Hypocrisy? A cynical attempt to curry favor from believers or to disarm those who might criticize the study of the human genome as reducing humankind to machinery? No, not for me. Quite the contrary. For me, the experience of sequencing the human genome and uncovering this most remarkable of all texts was both a stunning scientific achievement and an occasion of worship." Collins goes on to talk about this idea that the scientific and spiritual worldviews are at enmity with one another, at odds with one another. And he says it this way. He says, "In my view, there is no conflict in being a rigorous scientist and a person who believes in a God who takes a personal interest in each one of us. Science's domain," listen to this, "science's domain is to explore nature. God's domain is the spiritual world, a realm not possible to explore with the tools and language of science. That realm must be examined with the heart, the mind, and the soul, and the mind must find a way to embrace both realms." I've had more than one wise person say to me about a variety of things in a variety of ways, "Use the brain that God gave you." This debate is a fantastic occasion to use the brain that God gave us, to use the mind that we have. Why do we think that Scripture instructs us to have the mind of Christ formed in us? The mind of God. Remember, the staggering thing about the advent of Christ is not that Christ is like God, but that God is like Christ. And when we watch Christ move through the world, his world and his time, we watch his intelligence at work. We watch his engagement with meaning, and we also watch his engagement with mystery. We are being instructed on the practical, embodied, day-by-day, lived-in-the-world nature of having the mind of Christ formed in us. Science, says Collins, is the only reliable way to understand the natural world. That's why we don't rely on the Genesis poem for scientific information. It's not what the Genesis poets were trying to write. It's not a reliable way to understand the natural world. Science is the only reliable way to understand the natural world, and its tools, when properly utilized, can generate profound insights into material existence. But science is powerless to answer questions such as, why did the universe come into being? What is the meaning of human existence? What happens after we die? If I die, Daddy, am I going to heaven? Let me tell you about your DNA, boy. One of the strongest motivations of humankind is to seek answers to profound questions, and we need to bring all the power of both the scientific and spiritual perspectives to bear on understanding what is both seen and unseen. So when my 10-year-old asks me a question like that, I give him a meaning answer. And I also give him a mystery answer. And when he's older, he'll learn about the fascinating thing that is the human genome. And part of my hope is that having been given an answer that opens into many possibilities, he will see there, as Collins, the leader of the project, sees there, an occasion for worship and awe. Those are the kind of thinkings, those are the kind of musings and wrestlings that point us toward meaning in this conversation. What about mystery? Well, for mystery, no surprise, I'm going to turn to art. If I can get our musicians up here. They're going to give us a song by a fabulous Canadian singer-songwriter. One of the very few who's had enough of an impact on the culture to be decorated for it, Bruce Coburn. And they're going to sing us a very interesting, I think, song of Coburn's that is in this realm, the realm of mystery. Maybe one of the best gifts that we can give to ourselves and to the world around us is just to scrub out the verses between science and faith. And just be attentive to the story. Because the story is full of powerful, wonderful images. And if we will let those images inform our imagination and spill over into the way that we actually live as people of faith, people of spirit, in the world that God has made, it's going to change the way that we operate. Because instead of trudging along, trying to break the thing down into its constituent parts, finer and finer so that we can control it, even if we're fully engaged in that work, we can also be fully engaged as people who are just walking head on, open-hearted, open-minded into mystery, into the realm of God and of spirit, and saying, how does this inform the way that I interact with each of these people, each of these circumstances, all of my life? In a way that is going to attempt to understand it so I can control it. This is not a tirade against understanding. This is about the reductionist way of coming at the world through those things. That's problematic, just like it's a problem to come at the world through the reductionist part of religion. Part of the good gift that can emerge from that approach to the world and the approach to the sacred text of the story of the Bible is that it removes us from having to deal with all sorts of logical problems in the text. For instance, the way the Genesis text is laid out, light and dark are created before any of the engines of light and dark. We don't actually have the sun and the moon and the stars till like way after we have light and dark. Well, that's fine in a sacred poem, but it doesn't work so great as science. And so I could keep going, of course, but the text is just full of illustrations that it is not science. And we shouldn't treat it that way. And once we step away from that framework for the debate, all of a sudden we can start to encounter these texts for the beauties that they are. Just to humor me for one second.
If you have occasion to think about this, driving home from work, getting up in the morning at this time of the year, we're kind of getting out of bed and going to bed, most of us, right at that point between light and dark these days. Try to pinpoint the moment when dark becomes light or light becomes dark. We can say, here's the moment of sunrise or sunset, but we can't say, here's the moment where dark becomes light and light becomes dark. It's impossible. But we know it's happening. We know it's unfolding. We know something is opening or closing, so to speak. That's the realm that this text is written in. It's like an unfolding from dark into light, and it starts with nothing. Before anything is, God is. And from that beginning, it moves from simpler, and I suppose terribly profound as well, but from the single element universe that is just God and nothing to a universe that is increasingly complex and nuanced and layered and filled with more and more detail. We're invited by this text to do something like mapping the human genome, to just plunge headlong into the complexity as deeply as we can, confident that that complexity is going to reveal an awesome God, just the way that it does in the Genesis text, layer by layer, more and more complexity, deeper and deeper into God. Awesome stuff. This is a story that, among other things, says to us, don't try to tell me there's no mystery. It's everywhere I turn. I love a couple of the verses in that song. Moon over junkyard where the snow lies bright and cause my heart to burn. Coburn is a smart songwriter, and he has deliberately picked the perfect metaphor for the trash that's left over from the way that we operate in the world and said, even there, mystery can make my heart burn. Even there, God brings something into the world when it snow falls from the sky and blankets this heap of trash. And the trash heap becomes a way to see the light of God in the world. Mystery. A heart that burns inside of me. And that, Coburn reminds us, can intoxicate us like fine wine. Can come in through our body and explode inside of us in a way that points to, wow, all sorts of wonderful things. I think it's important for us to carry into the next part of this story as we continue our journey the truth that whatever else God is, whoever else God is not a disinterested divine being that kind of kicked things into motion however many years ago and then went on to other compelling projects, but is rather a God, although not limited by time and not bounded in power, chooses over and over again to take a personal, intimate interest in humanity, to the point of coming to be with humanity, to be humanity, to reveal God's self in an embodied way, so that when we live lives of spirit and of faith, we know that we're supposed to live them in an embodied way too. We're participants in the project that God is up to. And when we walk into the world looking for occasions for awe and wonder, we become people who live lives that are expressions of thanks to God for making us, the world that we live in, and the way that we can live in it, wonderfully, beautifully, complex. I think that's a gift when it comes to ways to live. Amen.